From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, the U.S. Supreme Court gives thousands of young Michiganders hope to stay in the country.
Not many people understand what it's like to live every day, not sure if you're going to be able to keep your driver's license, keep your job, stay with your family and your loved ones.
Also, a Detroit artist brings to life a monument to Malice Green and the wider community of Black citizens killed at the hands of police.
Just like him dying was a historical moment. Him being resurrected in a painting was also a historical moment. It showed the world that we remember. We're not just going to let this go. We're not going to forget.
Plus, we're touching base with one of the first Michigan bands to give a live performance on an actual stage in front of actual humans since the pandemic began.
When we finally got on that stage and started playing, it's just like, finally, we get to play again. Mm-hmm. It just feels wonderful.
Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today we're talking to artist Sydney G. James. She is unveiling a new mural in Detroit this week. It's a heartbreaking portrait commemorating the many lives cut short due to police brutality, featuring Malice Green, killed in the early 1990s.
I was just a child, but I remember how horrible it was. I knew back then that it was going to be a challenge to be Black in America.
But first, the United States Supreme Court has ruled that hundreds of thousands of young immigrants to the United States, many of whom have spent most of their lives here, can make their cases to stay in the country. It's a stunning rebuke to President Donald Trump's effort to end legal protections to the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, also known as DACA. These are the young men and women who we often call the Dreamers. Some came to the States as infants and toddlers, others as school-age kids. All say that they want to continue contributing in the U.S. as working adults, even as their lives get pulled again and again into intense election year debates about immigration. With us today are Julio Mejia and Maria Ibarra Freira, who both came to the States young and who are living and working in Southeast Michigan. Maria, Julio, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you so much for having us.
Glad to be here.
I wanted to just ask, first of all, how you're feeling about this decision. Julio, could you go first?
It feels great, you know, and it's awesome that they came to a conclusion, but it's still kind of just going to be in the back of my mind since from one of the articles I did happen to read, it said that the vote only came down to 5-4 and 4 against. So that kind of still leaves you on the fence on, what is this gonna? Are they gonna vote on this again, or is this gonna repeat again later on the year? So that's exactly how I feel right now, just on the fence about it.
Sure, Maria. I know that you were not feeling super hopeful about this decision as recently as yesterday. How about today?
Yeah, so much different. Yeah, we had anticipated and had prepared ourselves, I think, sort of as a protection mechanism that it was going to be a bad decision. And I myself was sort of already in that space. But today it just, you know, it was much better than we thought it was going to be. I feel relief. Also a little bit of shock. I don't think it's fully set in yet, but very, very happy with this decision.
You know, a lot of people know that the Dreamers are people who have been here for a long time, are often top of their class academically with, you know, professional positions in the community, but they may not quite understand the extent to which the uncertainty affects people's lives. And I wondered if I could ask you both if you'd be willing to tell us some ways in which the uncertainty has sat with you in terms of your daily life and your long-term plans. Maria, will you go first?
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, not many people understand what it's like to live every day, not sure if you're going to be able to keep your driver's license, keep your job, stay with your family and your loved ones. So you go every day living with this underlying level of anxiety and fear that really any day you could lose the life that you know. And it causes just a lot of fear, a lot of anxiety, a lot of confusion. I know a lot of people who have held on making plans, at least for myself. There's a lot of things that I like felt like I couldn't quite solidify because you never know what could happen. So it's you know, we have this was this positive DACA decision, but even then, as Julio said, who knows what could happen? We've lived our whole lives in the U.S. with this constant level of uncertainty. So, you know, even with DACA, first it was safe, then not, and then again, it was in danger, so just back and forth. So that even with having this positive decision with the Supreme Court, it still feels like, okay, what next? We're not going to be safe until it's permanent solution for all undocumented people.
Julio, how about you? I mean, are there things in your life that maybe might have been different if this cloud hadn't been hanging over you all this time?
Yeah, definitely. I just happened to enroll back in school since last time we spoke. I was going to take some summer classes, but the uncertainty of, I might not have DACA in the middle of the summer actually caused me not to take classes for the summer semester, just because I don't think I was going to be fully into school, and, you know, having that in the back of my mind just did not help at all. You know, gives you a little anxiety just thinking about it, and especially with, you know, needing the job because paying for school out of pocket and it, on top of cost of living and everything like that. Yeah, it definitely makes a dent in my life of planning, daily planning, and even as far as tomorrow. Don't know what might happen. So,
is your employer supportive?
My employer is very supportive. They know my situation. Every time it comes to renew, they always make sure that I have everything I need, and they make sure that I'm getting everything done in time, just so they know way ahead and they can prepare for me. You know, they talked about maybe getting position in a different country. So they're very helpful. So, you know, that really helps a lot.
Is it okay to say that you work in the tech industry?
Oh, yes.
Okay. What kinds of conversations has this meant for you, either with your bosses or your colleagues, about what's going on, what's been going on with the policy and the challenge?
With my bosses, they're always, you know, they see it from the other side. So they're always saying, oh, nothing's ever going to happen. You're going to be fine. That's always the answer that I get when I tell them, hey, you know, I'm worried about this, and we should plan ahead. And most of my colleagues, they don't know about it. I like to keep it a secret, or just don't like to talk about it, because some of them might disagree, and it's frowned upon to bring political views into the workplace. So I try not to bring it up. I do try to educate some of my coworkers when they do get a little curious about my status, and we definitely do have those conversations every now and then.
Yeah. The decision that the court handed down is very technical, and it talks a lot about the points on which the federal government rationalized dropping DACA. But there are points in the decision in which the majority you know, notes this is a thing that's happening to people. Are either of you feeling optimistic that more Americans agree with the decision the court made now than maybe a couple of years ago?
I would like to think so, especially since everything that goes on in the world, you know, it's a lot easier to communicate the news and anything that might be of importance to people. Many people who live here, you know, it's like 6 degrees of separation. They probably know somebody who has DACA, and they're probably understanding it more and getting familiar with the situation. So I think more people are for it. And I hate to say it, but how can you be against it? It's just something that is baffling to me to understand that.
Maria, I know that you do some advocacy work. What's your take on this?
Yeah, it feels so much different now than the political landscape when I first started organizing. It was for the DREAM Act about 10 years ago, where you couldn't even say the word undocumented without people fighting you on it. And now, you know, so much has changed, and it's sad that things had to get this bad in order for people to start seeing the humanity of immigrants. But I do feel like at least now the conversation of DACA is more popular. People know it. And I would say that, you know, most people probably at least have a little bit of an understanding of what it means. I think now the real challenge is going to be on how do we make sure that this doesn't happen again, that we don't have to go through a whole another court hearing to keep it valid, and also to make sure that the conversation doesn't just stay with DACA recipients, that there's a lot of people out there, you know, our parents, our family members, people who really were able, you know, who sacrificed so much for us to be able to be here, that don't have the same opportunities the DACA recipients. So, you know, to me, the fight is really out there to make sure that we don't leave behind the other 11 million undocumented people that have made it possible for us to be here and have all these benefits.
Is there anything that is on your mind as an appropriate next step?
Yeah, so we're doing a lot of work making sure that we have driver's licenses available for everybody, every Michigander, regardless of immigration status. And there have been bills. So there's two bills right now that are have been introduced last year in October in the Michigan legislature. And we're going to keep fighting to push them through and to make sure that we have enough support so that not just DACA recipients, but every undocumented person has access to a driver's license and to an ID. I think we've seen, especially right now with COVID, how crucial it is to have an ID to be able to get tested, to be able to get care. And it seems like a really ripe moment to show how all these issues are interconnected. So we, if you want to get more information about what this fight for driver's license looks like and how you can get involved, you can go to drivemichiganforward.com.
Julio, I had a question for you. Do you think that the Supreme Court decision means any changes in your future plans? Do you think you're going to go ahead and re-enroll?
I will definitely re-enroll in classes again. I would like to finish my degree at some point. But that's as far as my planning goes. You know, I've been thinking about buying a house, but that's also up in the air. The only plans I have is to stay in school as far as my future. There's nothing about traveling or family or anything like that, just because I don't want to be put in a situation where, you know, I don't want to be let down.
Yeah. We've been talking today with Julio Mejia and also with Maria Ibarra Freire about today's Supreme Court decision, saying that the federal government's effort to end the DACA program was not legal. Both of you, I want to thank you so much for your time and for sharing your thoughts today. We appreciate it.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. When you think about the amount of time that we're all spending at home this year and some of the seismic changes in public opinion that have manifested over the past couple of months, it feels like this could be a moment to reimagine all kinds of things. Maybe your employer is taking a different view of how many people need to be at work. Maybe you're thinking about cutting costs to deal with a new financial reality. In this context, Consumers Energy continues work on a clean energy plan to get rid of coal and help customers use less rather than building new power plants. The end goal is to get to net zero emissions by 2040. Patty Poppe is the president and CEO of Consumers Energy. She joins us now. Patty, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you. Great to be with you, April.
What have you seen as far as energy uses during the first wave of COVID-19?
Well, it's a very distinct pattern. The residential, our homes, are using a lot more energy than before, which is not surprising, while our businesses, especially our commercial customers, are using a lot less. And so even when we look back at 2008, the pattern did not look anything like this. So certainly the stay home, stay safe order is having people stay home, and that means they're using more energy.
They're using more energy
at home.
What does this tell you, consumers as an energy provider, about what to expect in the future?
Well, I think it tells us that we have an opportunity to truly engage with people and help both save the planet as well as their pocketbooks. I think a lot of times people think cleaner energy is more expensive. They think that the transition to clean energy will cost something. And I'm excited to be able to share with people that we can help you actually reduce your costs and do our part to save the planet.
So there was an incident in 2019, a particularly cold winter, January of that year, when a gas compressor caught fire. And you and the governor asked residents to turn their thermostats down to 65 to try to take the pressure off of energy demands. And they did. And especially during the early stages of COVID-19, the governor was asking residents to stay at home, maintain physical distance, and once again they did. What lessons do you draw from the willful action to try to ease the burden on the systems right now? I mean, we haven't really been in a position, looking at the macro view, in which government and corporate leaders ask people to contribute to a greater good.
Well, I do think that is a really important lesson we learned back in that very cold January. We learned that people want to be part of the solution. And so when we designed our clean energy plan for our electric business, that was on our gas business, but for our electric business, we realized that this sort of active mindset, this desire to play our part, was something that we should be tapping into, because the electric grid, different than the natural gas system, but the electric grid has a lot of excess capacity 90% of the year. But then on a couple hot summer days, our demand for electricity really peaks. And so as we're heading into the summer months here in Michigan, which I know everyone is excited and ready for, we see that the peak usage at home, that pattern is even higher than before because of the residential energy use at home. And so we want to prepare people for the summer and make sure that they have the ability to both protect the planet as well as, again, protect their pocketbooks.
Is it a worry that we're headed into summer months when it's much hotter and there will be more demand on air conditioners and fans and other kinds of cooling units at a time when people, are allowed to go back outside but may still be trying to be a little bit cautious about their personal movement?
Yeah, I wouldn't say there's a worry as in we don't have enough power. But when we look forward in the coming years, as we're retiring our remaining coal plants, and we've retired 7 of our 12, we have 5 more to close, we have scheduled dates for their retirements, and to get to our net zero plan, our clean energy plan for Michigan, we want to make sure that we don't have to build new power plants for those future years to serve that peak demand. And so in the interim, what we're working on is helping people reduce their usage on those peak moments, but we have technology available to us today that was never available before. Even back in the January incident that you referenced, we didn't have the technology that we have today that allows us to help customers have control over their usage and cool their homes in such a way that they're comfortable, but they minimize their peak use of energy, and that helps prevent our need to build additional power plants, which is the big win-win.
So the part of the plan is to provide people with thermostats that can act in a smarter way, as we say, and anticipate things. But these things do require some upfront investment. How can you convince people at a time when economic hardship is still very much a reality for people that this is a step worth taking?
Well, I can help in one way by making that upfront investment zero. We're very excited to announce our free thermostat program, which is a partnership with Google Nest. The Nest thermostats are now made by Google, and their partnership with us and another company called Uplight kicked off this program this year. Given COVID-19, we dramatically increased the participation potential. So we've given 40,000 thermostats away to date. We have 60,000 more. And if you're an electric customer of Consumers Energy and you have central air and Wi-Fi in your home, then you qualify for a free thermostat. So we encourage people to reach out to us so we can help get you signed up for the program.
There's been a concern that Americans may be so inundated with what's going on right now, the pandemic and the civil unrest that has swept over so many cities in Michigan, that there are a lot of important issues that are falling by the wayside, or that just don't have the, decision makers don't have the bandwidth to truly deal with right now. Do you have concerns that the pace of progress on climate change might fall farther back on the priority list at this time?
You know, I think I am not afraid of that right now, because the commitment runs deep. I would say that there are times when significant change can feel overwhelming. and people can feel helpless. But the reality is, at least at Consumers Energy, our clean energy plan really does provide the building blocks for both economic security as well as climate security. Our programs are designed so that all people can have access to cleaner and affordable energy and have a significant impact on preserving our planet for future generations.
Patty Poppe, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, April. Great to talk to you.
Patty is the president and CEO of Consumers Energy. Many clubs and bars reopened for the first time since stay-home orders went into effect. One of the venues that was open this weekend for the first time in a while was the Blind Pig. And on stage at the club was Sabbatical Bob, a funk band from Ann Arbor. And with us today are band leaders Ben Green and David Ward. Ben, David, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks for having us. We're happy to be talking to you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Nice to have you. Well, I mean, first of all, can you just real briefly talk about how you've been spending the time during lockdown?
I've been at home most of the time, working on various projects, mixing records. I was doing a series with our keyboard player, Jordan Anderson, called Groove of the Day. We just write some grooves and put them out online and just, you know, finding little ways to stay busy because not a lot to do.
Yeah, no kidding. What did it feel like to step back out on that stage with your band for the first time since the quarantine started?
Well, this is Ben. It was absolutely rejuvenating. Like so great to finally be back. So great to have everyone back in the same place and playing music together. It's just like magic. Like we've been apart for so long, and everyone came back to town the day before we had to play, and like when we finally got on that stage and started playing, it's just like finally we get to play again. Mm-hmm. It just feels wonderful.
What kind of crowd did you get?
So there was like a pretty good crowd. The capacity of the Blind Pig was reduced to 100 cap. The crowd obviously wasn't going to be like a normal show, but the crowd that was there was like super high energy. They were really excited to be there. We were really excited to be there. So I think like we still had energy to feed off of, and I think everyone had a great time.
Yeah. What kinds of things were you thinking about when you were making the decision when it was okay to play live again?
This is David again. We first heard that they were starting to reach out to other bands, you know, just hearing word of mouth. People were getting offers, and they were looking for other bands to play with them and whatnot. And so I think that day or something, I was talking to Ben and was like, would you want to play? And he was like, yeah, absolutely. Because we still figured there was going to be maybe like a virtual aspect or something like that. But at the end of the day, I really knew that if an establishment that's income is based on serving customers was to open up in a time like this, hopefully they would take the proper precautions so that their business can remain open. And, you know, if there's a bunch of outbreaks there, I'm sure this health department would have to shut them down and all that. So
make sure it's not just a short term opening.
Absolutely. Yeah, exactly. So I figured they knew they were doing that. We knew what we needed to do to be safe. They told us the precautions they were taking. And
yeah, all the staff were wearing masks. Most of the people inside were wearing masks. And every person that came through the door had to sanitize, like right at the door where they're checking IDs. So they had a big sanitization station. So they're doing things that made us feel a little more safe being in that space and being on the stage and playing for people.
For those who may know, the club is not huge to begin with. Were you able to distance on stage a little bit too?
I think on stage was about...
On stage, the horns were maybe a little close together, but we weren't playing with the full size band. We were missing a couple members just because people are across the country, back home, can't just like come out on a dime. So sure. One of our piano player, Jordan Anderson, is in Minneapolis, so he has to stay home right now. And like so, we were a smaller group than normal, so we could spread out a little more on stage. And as far as the people in the audience, it seemed like the people that came together, like, were sticking together and spreading out from the other people who kind of came in their own little groups. So that was kind of nice to see that people can have a good time and, like, still take precautions to control the spread of this.
Did you see many audience members masked up?
Absolutely. Yeah, there was quite a few people with masks. And some people weren't wearing them, but I'd say the majority of people were.
You know, that's really good to hear. I was seeing just anecdotal reports from bar scenes in some Michigan towns that it kind of looked like normal, expressing some real concerns that this would be a very short-lived reopening.
We were walking around outside before the gig, and like that's exactly what it looked like. We went over to a couple of the bars up the street, and there was no masks, and everyone was just... It looked like everything was back to normal. So
yikes. So know your bar before you go out.
Absolutely.
Payment for bands sometimes can really depend on capacity at the bar. How do you feel like the band's compensation is going to be affected, considering that venues are dealing with this mandate to just be at 60% reduced capacity?
This is David again. I think just based on... you know, what I already know and what we just recently experienced and the amount of clubs that have to shut down permanently, I think it's definitely going to affect how much a band can make, because the door is a heavy part of the income from the venue. That's usually the biggest part of it, or the only part that they can bump your percentage up or give you more money based on how many people show up. It affected the deal. We have a great relationship with the Pig, and they've helped us get gigs when, you know, maybe we weren't as known as they would normally have people be before they come in on a certain night, but we still turned up for them. They turned up for us, and the money was a little whatever, but I'm hoping that because of that the business can keep running, because we love that place, the community loves that place, and another aspect too is that now that show had to be 21 plus, which we've never done a 21 plus show, because I'm sure it's because of the capacity, they need to sell liquor to make their money, and so
right.
More people taking up space who can't buy liquor is not necessarily good for a bar business. So that's another aspect of that too. So bands whose fan base may be younger, that'll be harder too.
Something interesting, this is Ben, something interesting that I noticed was, even though we had a smaller audience, I think it gave a little more of a chance to connect with them a little more. And it seemed like people were, like, in between our set breaks and stuff, like we got a chance to like interact and like talk to people a little bit, and because of that our merch sales were much greater, and that was a good way to kind of subsidize that loss of money. Like, we can kind of pick up that aspect on our own end.
That's interesting. Yeah, people may or may not know that live performance is like one of the few durable forms of income, partly because merch and t-shirts and mostly recorded music sales have come to represent a smaller percentage of what bands tend to make. Can I just ask, I mean, you mentioned that some of your members are off the road now for reasons of their own, but I just couldn't help wondering, I mean, do the economics of a funk band still work at a time when there's all these extra considerations about how many people can be in the club, how much the venues can afford to pay? I've got to believe that folk singers who are, sort of a one-person operation might have the edge right now.
Well, they might have the edge as far as, like, they would then, just by default, being one person, get paid more by themselves. But I think, the most important aspect that, like, we think about when, like, we're going to, like, play a show together is, like, the music part of it. And, like, we want to play music for people. And, like, we understand that, like, the Pig can't really pay us right now because they're having a hard time just like we are. So it's more important that we do what we can to support our community and contribute towards like the upkeep of clubs like the Blind Pig, like Ziggy's in Ypsilanti, like all these great places around town, these beautiful gems that Ann Arbor and Ypsilanti have that anyone can go to and experience live music. It's really important that we do our part to continue like their upkeep. And besides that, I think while like a folk singer might have like that edge as far as just being by themselves, we all, like, the morning of the gig, all could hang out together and work on merch and make our merch together, which is, like, a really great blessing. And, like, that sense of, like, family that we have within the band is pretty strong. And then, like, we can help subsidize, like I said, that maybe the loss of money compared to that folk artist with our merch. So it's not, like, fully sustainable. Like, we can't pay everyone in the band a living wage especially right now, just on that model, because we're not working like 3-4 days a week. We it's just not feasible right now. There's not that many clubs open, but I think it's important that we are playing for anyone, whether that be online or whether that be a small 100-person gig at the Blind Pig.
Ben Green and David Ward are part of the band Sabbatical Bob, who returned to the stage triumphantly this past weekend at the Blind Pig. Guys, thank you so much for being there, and we hope you're able to get some gigs this summer and make it work.
Awesome. Thank you very much for having us.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. This week, Detroit artist Sidney James will show us a new public artwork that considers one Detroit man and the community of Black Americans whose lives ended violently at the hands of police. Friday, she plans to formally unveil Way Too Many, a memorial mural featuring the face of Malice Green and the names of many others. We should note that Friday also marks our observance of Juneteenth, when we remember how Black people in the West learned of their emancipation. Sidney James, welcome back to Stateside.
Hi.
Do you mind thinking back for us and telling what was going on with you in your life, I guess then your young life, when you heard about what had happened to Malice Green?
I was 13 when Malice Green got murdered. I remember the murder. I remember it happened after the LA riots. I remember it being all over, plastered all over media back then, which was newspapers and news, you know, on television. But we were bombarded with it. And I remember the original mural that Benny White Jr. had painted, like really at the site where Malice was murdered, and he was beat to death. I remember the media painting a picture of him like he was a crackhead and villainizing him. So that was what I was doing. I was just a child, but I remember how horrible it was. I knew back then that it was like it was going to be a challenge to be Black in America. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I can imagine that that was not the first time you had heard of such a thing happening. Did the incident?
Oh, no. Definitely not the first.
Did that one stand out for you in any way at the time?
It stood out because he actually died. It's like we always knew. But of course, if you have older Black parents, they're going to tell you what was going on. So I've always known like the struggles of Black people and the journey that we had been on. So really, I think for the world or my generation, the introduction to police brutality was definitely Rodney King. But the difference was, you know, Rodney King he didn't get killed.
The work that you've been working on is the second mural dedicated to Malice Green that was painted in Detroit. You mentioned that Benny White Jr. did the original.
Actually, it's not.
Oh, so I'm sorry.
I believe, I know there are several others around the city. But for me, the original work, what Benny did was the work that stuck with me. Because how he painted him. Like he painted Malice almost like a Black Jesus, if you will, with these Black tears streaming down his face. Because Malice Green was a handsome man. And if you made the picture, like the photo of him Black and white, he does kind of resemble what you would think a Black Jesus would look like. But it was like really the Black tears, because they were all of our tears. That was the one that I just thought would be there forever. Yeah. You know, that's the only one I think of when I think of Malice Green murals. I only think of that one.
Can you explain what happened to Benny White's mural?
So what I read in the article, and it was the day after George Floyd got murdered. It was an article that was about the Malice Green case. It mentioned the Malice Green case because, of course, Kim Worthy actually got convictions, not the convictions that they deserved, but they got convicted.
Kim Worthy, the Wayne County prosecutor.
Yes, yes. She worked very hard to get justice for Malice Green. So that original mural was a symbol of that justice for many. I know it was for me. So when I was reading this article and it was highlighting facts about the case and other things that had happened, at the end of the article, they mentioned Benny White Jr. And they talked about how the community, like even though it had gotten vandalized multiple times, Benny always went to go fix it, and the community really wanted it to stay. They wanted the mural preserved, but instead, the building got demolished. And when I read that, it really, it stuck with me. It pissed me off. I was angry. Mm-hmm. Because if nothing else, it should exist. Just because it's like another piece of us being erased. Because just like him dying was a historical moment, him being resurrected in a painting was also a historical moment. Because it showed media, it showed police, it showed the world that we remember. Like, we're not just going to let this go. We're not going to forget. This was a man. Like, all the other ones are men, women, children. And there are thousands. Like, even on the painting that I painted, because I painted Malice, but I didn't paint Malice Green as a man. I painted him as a monument.
So how did discussions start about you painting something from Malice Green on the wall of the Hamilton Tucker Art Gallery?
Well, when I read that the original was destroyed, I made the decision that I was going to paint a Malice Green mural. But it's painted on that wall because I'm part owner of that building. And I did it deliberately because I get to determine. I'm a piece of the decision of how it's preserved and how long it's preserved. Like, it's up to me, nobody else, not the city.
Yeah.
And I think that's important because a lot of the issues with erasure, appropriation, gentrification, all of these things is the main issue is we're not owners. Many times we don't own the property. So if you don't own, you really don't have a real say.
Yeah. So as you mentioned, you decided to portray Malice as a monument, as a statue. Could you talk about how you sort of the conception of the work and what you had in mind?
So what I had in mind was I definitely want to honor Malice Green. But I didn't want to mimic what Benny had done, or Mr. White, I should say that, because he is definitely an elder. I did give him a nod in my design, though, because right now, 28 years later, Malice is still an important part of the conversation. I had to make him a monument because he's a symbol. He's a symbol of what should have stopped then, what should not have been then. And now we have these thousands and thousands of names that have followed Malice's, you know, his fate, thousands. And so I didn't want to just paint Malice because it's not about Malice. It's about the malice that has been done to our people even since then and since 1619. So my initial plan was to paint Malice Green as a statue and he's holding a scroll. And the scroll contains the names of all of the people who have been killed and murdered at the hands of police brutality and injustice, right? My initial plan was to do it, to list all the names from 1979, the year I was born, up until now, right? That sounds like something that should be reasonable. But I was naive because I didn't know. Because everybody murdered at the hands of police are not documented. They're not headlines. Most have not been investigated. Just 2014, 2015 was well over 1,000 names.
If you're just joining us, we're talking today with Detroit artist Sydney James. Her latest mural is called Way Too Many, and it features the face of Malice Green, a Detroit man killed by police in 1992. So in the treatment that you settled on, you ended up with this scroll. It feels kind of significant that there are names that we can see and yet also the suggestion that there are many more names that we cannot see.
No, you can see them. You have to go to the wall, though.
Oh,
like you can't see them in a photograph. They're there. It's well over 1,000 names on that scroll.
Oh, Sydney.
Oh, they're there. That scroll is full. It's just different. It's different because it's different handwriting. It's different intents. That's why I designed it that way. And I didn't design it that way initially. It was all like it was an ever-growing thing in my brain. Like I sketched it out. That's when I posted it online. Then I sketched out a cleaner one when I posted online for the GoFundMe. After it was funded, I was still thinking like, how can I really make this message real or more real to viewers? And I was thinking, like, oh, it wouldn't just be one scroll because nobody's intention is ever to just create a ledger, a scroll ledger of just murders, right? It would have to be kind of a scrapbook or like a manic type of creation. So that's why you have paper taped onto it. You have line paper. We have headlines taped. And then we just have different handwritings because it wouldn't be something that would be orderly. And it's kind of reflective of even trying to find the database with all of the names. It's not in one place. You can't Google like black murders at the hand of police and get a real answer or a real database.
Right.
We had to pull from at least 20.
What was it like to be in communion with all those names as you painted them on the wall?
It was very, it was painful. So my assistants, who are my mentees, Backpack Durden, Ajayna Cortez, and Syra Dardis, they, even when they agreed to work on this with me, they did it with the thought of she shouldn't hold all that burden to herself. Like, she shouldn't be responsible for that burden, because it is a burden. Like, I only ended up having to write a couple names because Sabrina Nelson donated her time to write names because she's a hell of a calligraphist too. Halima Cassells, Ibrahima, like, these are people that I wasn't even anticipating being there, but it's like they hit me up like, hey, I want to participate. What do you need me to do? I'm happy to write names. Because they knew. But it was really hell. Like, the first day that they started the names, Syra and Backpack were up on a boom lift at like the highest point, starting like with the headliners, George Floyd, Breonna Taylor. I think his name is Tony McDade. Yeah. And of course, that one, I don't think they're even investigating. But they started writing a lot of the names. And I looked up, because I was, you know, toward the bottom working on my area. And I looked up and it just felt wrong. And I said, are you guys okay up there? They were like, no. And then when they looked down at me, both of them were in tears. Mm. So I pulled them down. We called it a night for the work. And we sat there on, you know, on this field, because it's a large piece of land connected to the building. And we sat there and we cried and we talked about it. Most of the names that they had started with were people under the age of 18.
Yeah.
Like, one of the real kids.
Well, we should say one of the names that's featured most prominently in the mural is that of Ayanna Jones. She was 7 years old when police entered one of her family members' homes, her grandma's, and they were looking for a suspect. Now, that story of Ayanna Jones has been told and retold, but the outcome was that the officers fired and killed her. And it's a story that stands out even among the multitudes of other Detroiters that we can name. Why did you choose to center her in that way?
Because nothing was planned as far as the names. I really only planned the look of it. The names kind of happened more organically. And once we started running out of space with just really 2 years worth of names, I just decided, okay, I knew Malice Green would be the first one on the scroll, but I feel like the last 2 days I decided that the names on the scroll had to be the Detroit residents. One is, of course, Ayanna Jones, who happened to be, I didn't know this at the time, but Ajayna revealed to me while we were painting that was her little cousin. It was like a third cousin, but that was her family. Mm. Like, these are real people connected to real people, connected to more real people. Like, we are people. It was another man, and he actually was murdered by stress years prior to my birth, but still the 70s, but this woman had contacted me on Facebook that I'm friends with, and she asked me to add her uncle's name, because he had been murdered in, I believe, 1971 by stress. One of those stress units that used to go around harassing black people in the 70s around the city of Detroit.
Yeah.
So it's Clarence, I think his name was Clarence Manning Jr. A woman named Jessica just hit me up, and I had to add his name because, of course, what do I look like? I'm going to deny you?
Some people may stop and look at the work and just ponder it. And as is always the case with murals, others may just pass by. And in that sense, the mural has to function on an ambient level. Did you do any thinking about what you wanted it to communicate in that way?
Nope. I just, because it's not for real. It was for me and it was for black people. It really wasn't for anybody else. I mean, I want people, it's for everybody else to see, but really to read the names. Like, and I made it aesthetically pleasing because it's such a terrible piece. Like, you gotta draw them in with something pretty, but once you draw them in with whatever this is, then they actually get to experience it. So I don't want people's experience at the wall to be like, oh, I don't want it to be like the engagement photo backdrop. You know what I mean? It's really a memorial.
Yeah. The unveiling is set for this Friday, Juneteenth. And that's a day when we think about freedom and also about freedom delayed. Was it important to you to show people this work on that particular day?
Definitely. Because I've been done with the work a week tomorrow. So people can really go by and see it whenever. But tomorrow is Juneteenth, and it is a day of celebration, but it's also a day of observance. And since it's a day of observance, I want people to come. It's not an event. It's not going to be a party. It's really just to honor the dead. Like, bring flowers if you want. Lay them at the wall if you choose. And really acknowledge the names, the souls that are presented on the wall. And then the souls that we couldn't list, the so many unnamed. I want people to feel this wall because it's painful to look at.
Yes. This is a time when Americans are in the streets. Sometimes those streets are painted with bright yellow letters that spell out Black Lives Matter. And this is also a time when we're seeing some older statues and monuments getting a public, I want to say a correction, you know, where people right. are, there's either information getting posted about, say, Confederate monuments, or they're simply being taken down, or sometimes given a public defacing as a way of correcting the record. In that kind of environment, have you thought at all about if there are new functions that murals are playing?
I think murals always play the same function, whether it's for the opposing team or the team that you play for. Public art, period, is really to expose, enlighten, brighten, depending on what the piece is. You know, the functions are different. But the main function is you give whatever it is to the people. You give the people a say. Because, you know, it could be propaganda. It could be facts. It could be a history lesson. Public art plays so many roles, but it takes it out of the hands of the elite who control all of the other messages that we receive. So it really puts it in a place, the hands of the artist, to tell the truths of the time.
Sidney James's mural, Way Too Many, will be formally unveiled this Friday, Juneteenth, 2020, on the outside wall of the Hamilton Tucker Art Gallery on Hamilton Avenue. Sidney, thank you so much. It's so good to hear your voice.
You too. Have a great day.
The deaths of Black Americans at the hands of police may be one of the most visible examples of systemic racism in the country right now, but it's not the only one.
The curriculum, of course, is very much written to, and forgive the term, to whitewash some of the more horrific parts of American history.
Tomorrow on Stateside, we'll talk about the role that schools play in reinforcing racial inequalities. Hope you can join us. That's our show for today. I'm April Baer. Thanks so much for listening. We'll catch you on Friday.